Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. California boasts the world's sixth largest economy, maybe the fifth, depending on who's counting. That's at the moment. But the Golden State has been up and it has very much been down. After decades of extraordinary prosperity, it sunk into an abyss. Less than 10 years ago, historian Kevin Starr said it was on the verge of becoming the first failed state in America. Looking at that history and speculating about the future, Manuel Pastor says California is America fast forward. He is a professor at USC. He's a prolific author, and his latest book is State of Resistance. Welcome to our podcast.
Glad to be with you.
We're going to be talking about resistance, and we're going to be talking about how California is America fast forward. But let's begin with the history. Tell us about the days of Earl Warren and Pat Brown, the governors of different parties, Republican and Democratic consecutively, and what they meant for the state.
You know, in the book, we try to start by asking the question, when did California work? And it's arguable that California worked well in the 50s and the 60s. There were all sorts of problems with racial segregation and discrimination in labor markets, et cetera. But there was also a sense of a place of abundant opportunity and real possibilities for people to realize their dreams and attain some degree of mobility and their own little piece of the California dream. And a lot of that had to do with the groundwork that was laid by Earl Warren and Governor Pat Brown. And that was a sense of investment in the future. This was a state that in the 50s and 60s was investing in infrastructure, water and roads, that was building housing. In that particular era, it was suburban housing, sort of sprawling in ways that we don't like now, but we were certainly building sufficient housing. And most importantly, under Pat Brown, the investments in what was called the Master Plan for Higher Education, that is making the sort of three-part system of the University of California, the California State Universities, and the community colleges articulate together and provide a way to create a sort of skilled labor force. So really what that era reflected was a sense of investment in the people who were in the state, the next generation, and also really a sense of welcoming. This was a state, the share of the national population was continually growing. This was a state that in the 40s and 50s took on the task of integrating a population people said couldn't be integrated, people who'd come from Oklahoma who lacked education, et cetera. So this was really a state which had a sort of social compact about welcoming the newcomer and investing in the next generation. And it's really key to ask not only how did it work and when did it work, but also how it all fell apart.
One of the keys, of course, was the World War II and what it meant for the economy when California was generating how many ships and airplanes and getting into the manufacturing business.
Yeah, there was a hugely significant share of federal procurement spending that was going to California, and it really did help to boost the economy. But I think it's important to realize that that was actually sort of a continuation of earlier trends. Even during the Great Depression, the Golden Gate Bridge was built, the Bay Bridge was built, the Pasadena Freeway was built. This was a place that actually, unlike a lot of other places in the United States, the population actually grew during the 1930s. So it was a place that, you know, even in the midst of the Great Depression, had sort of an investment ethos, had a sort of bipartisan consensus, too. You know, it's fascinating to realize that Earl Warren won, not just as a Republican, his preferred party, but he was also the Democratic candidate and the independent candidate as well. So this was a state that had a lot of history of investment in infrastructure. It had a kind of bipartisan commitment, had Republicans that sort of bought into large parts of the New Deal, and then along came the war. And what the war did was basically jumpstart a lot of the the manufacturing industries in California lead to lots of even more investment and lead to this massive inflow of people who are escaping the Dust Bowl. Some of them had been coming in the 1930s, and also the folks who were part of the Great Migration, African Americans from the South, who came to California. So World War II, an important moment, but it was really part of a trend that was there before and was sort of codified in the post-war period by this commitment to investment in infrastructure, in housing, and in human capital.
There was, however, sort of beneath the surface, an issue that has risen again and again, and you've alluded to it. People were coming from the South, African Americans in particular. People were also coming from the Midwest. They were not African Americans. They were white. And consequently, there was separation in California.
Yes, there was significant racial segregation in California. But what's fascinating is to realize how race wound up sort of helping, and I should say really racism, not race, derailing where California was heading. You know, one of the things we cover in the book is the sort of antecedents to what many wind up calling the racial propositions of the 1990s. Of course, in 1994, we, as a state, passed Proposition 187, the rather famous proposition that tried to strip away all sorts of social services, including education, from undocumented residents in the state of California, soon to be followed by the banning of affirmative action and the elimination of bilingual education and a number of laws that led to the over-criminalization and over-incarceration of black and brown youth. But the antecedents for that were already there in the 1960s. In 1963, the state Assembly and Senate passed a bill that was guaranteeing fair housing, that is trying to eliminate discrimination in the residential labor markets. And in 1964, the real estate industry put on the ballot something called Proposition 14, which was a proposition that basically reallowed segregation in housing. That is, it said that because private property was private and people could decide what to do, the government couldn't force you in the market to sell to someone who was African American or Latino or Asian. And that passed overwhelmingly. And that was a sort of declaration of sort of white supremacy and white resistance to the changing demography that began to change in the 1960s and that really accelerated in the 1970s. Interestingly, one of the people who was very prominent in that campaign to, quote-unquote, protect private property rights and reinstitute segregation was Ronald Reagan, who wound up being able to launch his gubernatorial campaign a couple of years later based on his prominent role in Proposition 14. So these are very deep roots, and they really get to the question of how race and racism helped to derail the social compact that had been key to California's success.
People around the country may not remember that Ronald Reagan was governor of California starting in 1967. He was elected in 66 and served for 8 years. He had two terms. How was it that he was able to take over a party with the Proposition 14 argument that you mentioned, which was resegregating residential parts of the state, when Earl Warren, his predecessor, between them was Pat Brown, the Democrat. But what had happened to the Republican Party in the meantime?
Well, you know, as we try to argue in the book, California is America fast forward in many different ways. Our demographic change between 1980 and 2000 is the demographic change in the United States between 2000 and 2050. The sort of shocks of deindustrialization that rippled through California in the early 1990s wound up sort of banging up the Midwest in the decades of the aughts with the Great Recession in the late 2007, 2008, et cetera. And this is another way in which we are America fast forward, which was the changing of the Republican Party. So the Republican Party, which had produced an Earl Warren, who, you know, had a mixed record on race. He was quite supportive of the internment of Japanese Americans.
He was very supportive of the internment. He really ran on it in 1942 when he first became governor. He had been attorney general.
Yeah, he used that as a way of saying that he was tough on law and order. But this is the same guy who, with the Warren when he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is was so key in Brown versus Board of Education, and so key in so many other things advancing civil rights. He came from that Republican Party that was more bipartisan in its tone, more accepting of elements of the New Deal, trying to push forward on the issue of race and racism. Now, Ronald Reagan was someone who, used the language of private property rights, but really was sort of making an appeal to white suburban homeowners. He was someone who said he was going to be tough on the students and break, crack down on the sort of University of Berkeley protests that were going on. He was sort of the new face of the Republican Party, in the way in which the Republican Party over the years has shifted to, in the past, a sort of dog whistle around race. Now with Trump, it's more or less a bullhorn around race. And so I think it's really indicative that that was all dressed up in the language of property rights.
Obviously, the demonstrations in Berkeley were about the civil rights initially, but they ended up being about the Vietnam War.
Yes, and I think it was really symbolic of a sort of, rising up of a younger generation. And that had some particular race aspects to it as well, because in the 1960s, as the students were rising up at Berkeley and Ronald Reagan was cracking down, you also saw the emergence of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, sort of presaging the rise of Black Lives Matter now. You saw the emergence of the Chicano movement, particularly in East Los Angeles with the walkouts of the students, and the sort of increased militancy of African Americans and Chicanos, Latinos in the state began to cause much more anxiety amongst the white population that was increasingly an older population, looking at a younger population that looked different and the one that was much more militant.
So it's often said that the electorate in California is older, whiter, older and whiter and richer than the population. How did this translate into actions, particularly the enactment of various statewide propositions that sort of institutionalized the opposite of what had made the state so successful?
Well, one of the things we try to highlight in the book is the important role of Proposition 13. Proposition 13 was a ballot proposition that passed in 1978. And essentially what it did was ratchet back the percent at which you could tax property. And then it had said that unless the property changed hands, the assessed value could only rise by a very low percentage each year. It essentially locked in tax advantages for an older and whiter set of homeowners, and it meant that a younger and more diverse set of home buyers would wind up buying property at its full market value. It would be reassessed, and they would wind up paying higher taxes. It also wound up fiscally starving the state in a way that meant less investments in public education and all sorts of other things that were critical for the success of this younger and more diverse generation. In some ways, Proposition 13 foreshadowed the more explicitly racial propositions of the 1990s, and it was a sort of declaration of generational warfare. It was protecting the assets and privileges of this older, whiter population, more established homeowners, even as there were increasing needs amongst a younger, more diverse population. Now, that sort of came to full fruition in the 1990s with the ballot propositions we talked about.
Wait a minute. Before you get there, let's just pause for a moment at Proposition 13 in 1978, because at the time, the governor of the state was Jerry Brown, the man who came back and is governor of the state once again. He was the son of Pat Brown, one of those sort of bipartisan governors, along with Earl Warren, who had governed the state during times of great prosperity. And he allowed there to become a huge surplus in Sacramento while taxes were going up and elderly people were being starved out of their homes, not starved out of their homes, were being taxed out of their homes. At least that was the argument that was made. And he didn't do anything about it.
He's allowing another surplus to accumulate right now, too.
That's right.
Which is kind of interesting. But, Jerry Brown's willingness to let the surplus accumulate certainly fed into Proposition 13 and the way in which the state assembly and the state senate did very little about the problem were also a challenge. But essentially what was going on, you're right, was that property values were going up. Older homeowners on fixed incomes were finding themselves bearing taxes that they felt like they couldn't afford. And there was a fix there that was available, which was to carve out an exception for older homeowners, low-income homeowners, so that they wouldn't have to see their taxes rise as their assessed values rose. That's not what we passed. What we passed was something that protected all homeowners, not just those who were the most vulnerable. And we also passed a tax cut for those homeowners that essentially wound up becoming a Trojan horse for corporations. Because it turns out that the share of property taxes paid by residential homeowners actually rose in the period after Prop 13, and then the share being paid by corporate property owners actually fell. Why? Because corporate property owners are much better able to hang on to property over a long period of time, not have it change hands, or use sort of legal mechanisms so that even when it changes hands, it doesn't change official ownership in a way that would trigger a tax reassessment. If you think about that, then Prop 13 was a tax cut that was a bit of a Trojan horse for corporate interests, which is a little bit like the tax cuts that just got passed in Washington, which are promising modest relief for middle-class taxpayers and gigantic relief for corporations. So, again, California was a little bit there first.
And, as you have indicated, California leads the way so often. After Proposition 13, we had Governor Brown himself saying, I may learn slow, but I learn good, going for tax cuts. And tax cuts began to spread across the country.
Well, the other thing I think that Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, did in his first term that I think was a sort of big mistake was that after the voters passed Prop 13, and there was a huge shortfall of resources for the local counties because that's who really was receiving the property tax revenue. The state used its surplus, reasonably enough, to sort of backfill the gaps that were there at a county level. And the problem with that was that it gave taxpayers and voters a kind of sense of magical thinking where they thought that, well, you can cut taxes, but it's not really going to cut services. But, you know, you can only tap into your accumulated surplus for so long. And after a couple of years, what began to happen is that there were real shortfalls at the county level and at the state level in terms of necessary spending.
The surplus went away.
Yeah, one of the biggest things I think Jerry Brown did that was a mistake was to let Californians think that there would be no pain when you cut taxes. And that kind of magical thinking is exactly what Ronald Reagan ran on when he ran for president just 2 years later. He pointed to Prop 13, the tax-cutting fever. He said, look, we did it and it caused no pain. It was really a temporary blip. And he wound up coming into office cutting taxes at the federal level and causing massive deficits and debt accumulation, a little bit like George W. Bush did when he came back into office and what Donald Trump is doing right now. So this sort of magical thinking that you can cut taxes without cutting services, Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, helped to contribute to.
So the comparison of what's happened in California and what happens is happening in the nation as a whole a little bit later, as you say, is really interesting. Let's go back to the 1990s, and what were the propositions? California, of course, has these propositions, and they can become part of the Constitution. They're impossible to get rid of once you've passed them, or they're very difficult to because they have to it requires a two-thirds and sometimes a three-quarters vote to overturn them. What sort of things were passed into law?
Well, it was, the passed, but actually never became really effective because so much of it was unconstitutional, was Proposition 187 in 1994. That was the proposition that basically said that undocumented immigrants in California would not be able to access any kind of social services, and even their kids would not be able to go to California schools. Just a couple of years later, we passed a ban on affirmative action.
Well, very, very quickly, Prop 187 wasn't just unconstitutional. It also would have threatened public health if a lot of people in the state weren't able to have medical treatment at all.
It was a pretty ill-conceived idea, but it really, I'm not sure, was conceived of as a bit of public policy and more as a kind of anti-immigrant spasm on the part of the electorate, and also as a vehicle for Governor Pete Wilson, who was far behind in the polls and was trying to figure out what he could use to kind of run a re-election campaign that would be successful. And he realized that there was an anti-immigrant sentiment, that it could be exploited, and that by exploiting it, he could gain electoral office. Turned out to be a good short-term strategy. Wilson got reelected. Turned out to be a sort of long-term disaster for the Republican Party, because what it did was convince, you know, the story I always tell is that my dad came from Cuba to the United States, and he always proudly called himself Cuban. After Prop 187, he started calling himself Latino. And the reason why was this was perceived not just as a discussion about undocumented immigrants, it was perceived as an anti-immigrant, anti-Latino measure, and it wound up sort of permanently alienating Latino voters from the Republican Party, and that wound up weakening the Republican Party, along with a series of other factors moving forward.
Also in the 1990s, there were measures passed, and some of them did stay in law, that were designed to crack down on what was perceived as crime.
Yes, we passed a three strikes law, which meant that if you had three felonies, you would be basically permanently put in, you'd be given life imprisonment. Three strikes and you're out. We passed a
and
law.
And it didn't matter what the third felony was, and in one case it was a guy who stole a piece of pizza.
Yeah, that was probably the most dramatic case, but there were others like that as well. And we also passed legislation that allowed for juveniles to be tried as adults. This was the era in which people were concerned about quote-unquote young predators. So there was the interesting thing, the backdrop for, you know, there's a political scientist named Daniel Hosang who calls it that decade the era of racial propositions, because so many of them were directly targeted at issues having to do with race, banning affirmative action, banning bilingual education, this kind of criminalization, which had a sort of glow to it of targeting African Americans and Latinos. Interestingly, the backdrop for this is the following. There's a concept we talk about in the book called the racial generation gap, and that's the percentage of the population above the age of 65 that's white, compared to the population below the age of 18, that's kids of color. So basically, it's a sort of measure of the demographic distance between the old and the young. Interestingly, the racial generation gap in California peaked in 1994 to 1998, exactly the era in which all of these propositions were passing. In some sense, an older generation was not seeing itself in a younger generation, and so it was sort of stripping away the protections and investments that younger generation needed. One of the parallels to the national scene, again, is that the racial generation gap at a national level, the comparison of the demographic composition of the old to the demographic composition of the young, that racial generation gap is peaking, according to projections, in the United States in 2016, the year that we wind up electing Donald Trump to the presidency.
And it's worth pointing out from a political standpoint, what happened to the Republican Party as a result of this demographic change in the aftermath of passing those measures? The Republican Party is practically dead in California.
There's not a single statewide elected office held by a Republican. There's a two-thirds majority for Democrats in both the state assembly and the state senate. The Republicans are more or less irrelevant in most of the races that are going on right now. The Republican Party registration has dipped precipitously. And this was partly the reaction of Latino voters. One interesting thing that happened, particularly after Prop 187, was that the naturalizations of immigrant residents stepped up dramatically, and naturalized Latino immigrants actually vote at a higher rate than U.S.-born Latino immigrants, than U.S.-born Latinos, because they were so sort of energized by what they perceived as an anti-immigrant sentiment being put out there by the Republican Party. But it's not just the sort of Latino empowerment, engagement, and transformation. It's that there's been a rising labor movement. There's a rising sense of concern around the environment. There's an openness to diversity and understanding the reasons why it's important. There's an openness to LGBTQ issues in California. And on all of these issues, the Republican Party in California basically was not in step with the population. And this, I think, is part of what's happening at a national level now as well.
So let's just summarize for a moment here. We have up to 1990 and even the year 2000, when Kevin Starr said California is likely to become a failed state. We had the starving of resources. No longer could the state afford education, even if they had been willing to pay for it, and the system was declining. The infrastructure was declining as well. And now, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but over the past 10 years or so, or even less than 10 years, it is back in business in the place where it used to be. Now, your book is called A State of Resistance. Was it resistance that led the state to out of the abyss and into the situation where it is now?
Well, resistance played a role. I mean, one of the things we try to say in the book is that there's a sense, you know, that Jerry Brown rescued California, that, you know, he made a sort of a mess of it the first couple of terms, comes back and has really straightened things out.
He was elected in 2010.
Yes, but there's a... And then he will be exiting very soon.
And I should just say very quickly for those around the country that Arnold Schwarzenegger had been the governor before him. He left with an enormous deficit at the state. Jerry Brown came in 2010, and now we have a surplus once again in the state.
We have a surplus, but the reason why we have a surplus is because we passed a tax increase, modest sales tax increase accompanied by a pretty significant surcharge on higher incomes in order to be able to fund the state. We have raised the, for one of the first two states in the United States to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. It'll be there in a few years. We have become what's a so-called sanctuary state that is very welcoming of immigrants and not cooperating with immigration and customs enforcement. We are moving ahead on dealing with climate change, and not only dealing with climate change in terms of trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but trying to use the revenues from cap and trade to invest in communities that have been overexposed to environmental hazards and that are socially vulnerable. So there's been a really dramatic shift in the politics of the state and the reality of the state. You're right now, folks are claiming that this is now the fifth largest economy. California attracts 50% of the country's venture capital. The state is back and roaring in certain kinds of ways.
But so the sanctuary movement, though, has led to a backlash, and there are cities around the state that are saying, wait a minute, we don't want to provide sanctuaries. We want our police to deal all the time with the immigration authorities, even though even in some police, particularly in the big cities, are saying that's not a good idea because then people who are fearful of the police won't help to enforce the law at a lower level.
Well, there's always going to be a backlash. And it's, you know, should have been anticipated that this would have one do. There's been a backlash to every one of the sort of moves that I've mentioned. But, you know, the state government is committed to it. The bigger cities are committed to it because they know that it's better for community policing. The attorney general is committed to it and willing to go to court against the federal government. And it's a series of small, conservative, older cities that are reacting. It's not entirely surprising.
Well, what about resistance and the new leaders in the legislature saying very specifically when Donald Trump was elected, we are going to resist?
Yes. I mean, it was pretty dramatic. The day after the election, the Speaker of the Assembly and the President pro tem actually put out a letter indicating that they would resist and also reminding us that while California was not around at the beginning of the United States, it may well be its future. But I think in terms of thinking about how the resistance sort of set up this situation, it's important to realize there were a series of structural factors that changed, and then also sort of an important role for what we are now thinking of as the resistance that didn't just emerge with the election of Donald Trump. On the structural side, some economic factors were important. One was the rise of Northern California in the Silicon Valley. It's a place that's the dynamism now of the state in terms of the economy. It's also a place that's much more liberal, welcoming to immigrants, recognizes how diversity leads to economic empowerment. There were some important shifts in the political rules of the game. One of the ones that people didn't pay too much attention to was term limits. There was a lot of hand-wringing about term limits because the idea was that if we were limiting politicians from being able to spend too many terms in office, that they and their staff would lose expertise. But it also made it quite possible for people who were pretty unusual to rise to the top. So Karen Bass, who had started a community organizing group in South Los Angeles, becomes the first African-American female head of a state legislature anywhere here in California. And the president pro tem of the Senate, who signed that letter that we were just talking about declaring resistance to Trump, Kevin De Leon, actually cut his teeth being an organizer against Prop 187 in 1994. So term limits made it possible for younger politicians of color with organizing backgrounds to rise to the top. But there's actually an important role for resistance as well. And one of the things we spent a lot of time talking about in the book is the way in which organizers sort of shifted their thinking in the 90s and the aughts in a way that helped to build power that actually had some important lessons for the United States state of resistance today. Some of that was about, you know, in the past, a lot of people who were perhaps very progressive, very left, tended to reject electoral politics. Now, in the Californians, progressives became very involved in trying to get involved in elections. Another really key thing was to try to change the electorate. That is, to try to go out to new and occasional voters, particularly of color, and energize them to be able to vote and change who was voting. This required a new form of engagement called integrated voter engagement, where instead of just helicoptering in at the time of elections with a light tap to get your regular voters to show up, you instead do a lot of community organizing between elections, build relationships, bring people out. And another really key thing was to move from just opposing things to proposing things. So not just opposing bad corporate behavior, but talking about raising the minimum wage. Not just being opposed to big oil companies, but trying to propose new systems to deal with climate change. There's a lot, I think, progressives on a national level have to learn from what happened here in California.
And what about getting support from the business class and going back to the era of success in California when there was a public-private partnership that was really basic, it seems to me, from what you've said, to the way that the state was able to prosper? That might happen again.
Well, I think there's a possibility for it to happen again, and one of the things I think that makes that clear is that a lot of California businesses, I mean, I was struck by when President Trump instigated his first Muslim ban, and one of the first people to go protest in San Francisco airport was Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders of Google, who then, the following Monday, staged a demonstration against the president's travel ban on the Google campus. That's something you can do if you own a Google campus. But what's really striking is that a lot of businesses have realized that the sort of retrograde policies of the past are not really going to be what works for a modern economy. You need to be able to be lifting up the bottom of the labor market with increases in the minimum wage. You need to be open to immigrants and the talents that they bring. you need to, if you want to sort of get ahead in the markets that are going to emerge, cooperate with the government around environmental regulations so that we can develop green tech, solar power, and all the other things that will make us have our first mover advantage in world markets. And so I think there's been a kind of shift in key parts of the business community. There's ways in which progressives have learned to work with parts of business. It's always a delicate balance because it's really fundamentally a question of power. But I think there's a new paradigm emerging here, too.
You are a progressive, obviously. You think that that is what is good. You are a person of color in the sense that you're descended from a Cuban father and a mother who was Latina. And you, at the end of the book, have some suggestions about what the real lessons are. And as we look forward to the elections coming up this year, one of the things you say is the ninth lesson, do not move to the middle, move the middle. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that if you go back to Prop 187, and I'll take it to today, that the mainstream argument against Prop 187 was similar to something you mentioned, which is that if we cut people off from social services, they will get diseases. And also if we cut kids off from education, they'll be roaming the streets. Kind of all that's true, but it winds up giving the image of immigrants as sort of pests or dangers that's there, rather than saying that we should reject Prop 187 because it denies the fundamental humanity of people who are here. So it seems to me that moving the middle versus moving to the middle is about what the LGBTQ movement did around marriage equality, rather than trying to move to the middle and say, well, it's just about civil rights. They tried to really center it around people's right to love who they wanted to love and people's right to be able to form families in the ways that they wanted to form families. Moving to the middle would be having a lot of compromises on immigration reform. Moving the middle is trying to really reinstigate the whole notion of welcoming the stranger. Moving to the middle is about saying, well, you know, we're just going to have a modest increase in the minimum wage. Moving the middle is about talking about why the fight for 15 is actually crucial. And so I think one of the things is that if you have the kind of politics of compromise rather than the politics of vision, it's going to be very hard to animate people to get out there to vote. Do people need to be pragmatic? Yes. And I do think that one of the lessons of the California experience is that progressives maintained and organizers maintained a whole lot of vision and big picture thinking, and they were also willing to figure out where the pragmatic compromises were. But all of that was with an eye toward sort of moving the middle.
Compromise versus vision, that goes to a dispute that's going on within the Democratic Party, the Sanders people on the one side, the so-called traditionalists on the other, and is turning up in congressional districts all over the country. Very quickly, final point has to do with national leadership. California in the past has had presidents, obviously, President Nixon, President Reagan, but not for a long time have we produced a national leader in California. You talk a lot about how the resurgence in California was due not so much to any individual, even Governor Brown, though he's had an important role, but rather to organizers at the grassroots. Do you think that's key to the United States as well, or do we need a national figure, a sort of anti-Trump person, to set things right as according to your standards?
You know, one thing that's a question that you didn't ask that will actually get me to answer the question you just asked is about what stirred me to write the book. And what's interesting is it certainly was prompted by an election, but not by the election most people think. It was actually prompted by the election of 2008 when Obama got elected, and a lot of progressives sort of bum-rushed Washington, thinking that if they went to Washington, they could change a few policies, and that would change the world. When instead what they should have done is go back to their communities and do the kind of, you know, grassroots movement or community organizing and movement building that would have provided wind to Obama's sails or held him accountable when he was doing the wrong thing, such as around deportation. And into that void stepped the Tea Party, which, as much as it was astroturfed by the Koch brothers, did have a kind of grassroots mobilization element to it. And one of the things that was prompting me to think about the book well before the election of 2016 was that we really needed to understand that what turned California around was not just some rule changes, not just some economic factors, but it was a lot of this, not just a single leader, but it was a lot of this grassroots mobilization where people were able to build the kind of local power that could raise living wages, then local minimum wages, then a state minimum wage, that could raise local voices around environmental injustice and then introduce environmental injustice into statewide climate policy, that could raise the protection of immigrant rights at a city level and then gravitate that up to a state level. So it was really clear to me that it was grassroots organizing, social movement building that had helped to transform the state. And it became even clearer to me after the election of Donald Trump, which was the second election that got me to rework the book and really rush it out there, that we needed to lift up the importance of organizing. Because if we think that a single political leader is either going to bring us out of the mess that we're in, or if we think that a single person, Donald Trump, is responsible for the mess we're in, Donald Trump is a manifestation of impulses that exist within the American electorate and a kind of political opportunism that's out there as well, particularly in the part of the Republican Party. And that needs to be dealt with through grassroots mobilization. So what gives me hope right now, Warren, is not that there's a single leader that's going to emerge, but all of these groups, the indivisible groups that have done organizing at local levels for local elections, the Women's March, the March for Our Lives, the kids at Parkland and others helped put together, the way in which the Dreamers have really shifted the discourse around immigration, the way in which Black Lives Matter movements have shifted the national momentum around policing. It's really these grassroots groups that if they could continue to do the organizing and then to begin to build intersectional solidarity, to actually get these streams of organizing to come together, that's what's going to fundamentally change America and not any single leader.
The idea is California is America Fast Forward. The book is State of Resistance. The author and the man I've been talking to for the last 45 minutes is Manuel Pastor. He is a professor at USC. And I want to thank you very much for being on our podcast.
Always a pleasure being with you.
This edition of To the Point, produced by Andrea Brody, our engineer Joel Stein. I'm Warren Olney. You can get To the Point wherever you get your podcasts. And when you do, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. That'll help spread the word. And let us know what you think of what you're getting and what you'd like to get next. Join us again.
Por mi madre, yo soy mexicano. Por destino, soy americano. Yo soy de